This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Eun Teck. Grania Kno is the Professor of Learning Innovation and Director of the Institute of Innovation at the University of Leicester. I am pleased to have her in the studio with me to talk about innovation in learning and the future of education. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You argue that we are now in the third phase of learning environments, the first being a virtual learning environment and the second is the personal learning environment. Describe what the third phase looks like for us.
Okay, I think first it's worth saying more broadly that technologies offer an amazing variety of ways in which students can interact with rich multimedia, ways in which they can communicate and collaborate with their peers, with their tutors, and indeed beyond the formal classroom on a global network. So that's very, very exciting. The concept of learning environments emerged when institutions started to buy what were called virtual learning environments, and these were tools that provided a variety of ways in which students could communicate and collaborate, ways in which teachers could upload content, ways in which students could upload their assignments and get feedback, etc. There are a lot of very well-known virtual learning environments. Moodle, for example, from Australia. Blackboard is one that we use extensively in the UK. The concept of personal learning environments emerged from a group of people that felt it was important to look beyond the institutional context, who argued that students were not just using these institutional tools, but were picking and mixing different tools that were available in the cloud. So they might not be using the institutional email system, for example. They might be using Gmail, so that they could mix and create their own personal or personalised learning environments tailored to their particular needs. We need to go beyond this to look at what I called PLE Plus. And this is because of a number of factors. It's about really saying that when students are creating their own personalised learning environment, they're not just taking account of the digital tools, as I mentioned before, they're actually also taking account of the physical dimensions. So most students now have mobile devices, whether those are phones or smart devices like iPads, for example, and they're using these extensively for their learning. You only have to walk down the street and you'll see people glued to their phones. We also have something called the concept of the Internet of Things, which means that it's now possible to tag physical objects. So I could tag this bottle of water and it would tell me when the water was nearly finished, so I need to refill it. Or I could tag my plants at home and it would warn me that they needed to be watered. Or I could tag my tyres and be able to know that the tyre pressure was low and I needed to readdress that.
How would that help our learning though, like having the Internet of Things?
Well, I think that's an interesting point. We don't yet know exactly, but clearly it has enormous potential. Related to that is the concept of what we call learning and analytics. So we can, underneath our learning management systems, there's vast amount of data about students, when they log in, how long they're there for, which materials they're looking at. So that material, that analytic data, can be made available to teachers. So I, as a teacher, can see these students are struggling, so I can get in touch with them and help them. Or I can see that all the students are having a problem with this particular concept, so I can say, you're all having a problem with this content, let's have a seminar about it next week. But I can also make that material available to learners. So you may have heard of RunKeeper. So people who are into jogging can have a little app and it will tell them that they've taken 25 minutes to run however many kilometres. And they can keep a record. They can post information about their goals and see how well they're doing. Well, you can imagine doing the same with the learning context. So I, as a learner, can set myself goals on what I want to achieve by a particular time, and the data will say, well, you've achieved goals 1 and 2, but you're a long way off this. Or I can say to a student, you've studied for 5 hours a week, but actually, on average, your classmates are studying for 12 hours. Or you appear to be doing all your learning on a Sunday afternoon. Research shows that it's better to do it in bite-sized chunks over the week. So these can be really, really powerful tools that can be made available to both teachers and to learners to improve their learning. So the concept of PLE Plus is taking account of these things and going beyond just the mere digital to looking at the physicality as well and enabling teachers and learners to help them to design the most effective and appropriate learning environments.
So we know where the potential is. So why do most universities and colleges, or even schools, we know that they are still operating in phase one, where they are using Blackboard and similar content management systems, and there's some but limited integration of technology into their teaching? Why is that?
Absolutely. Very good question. There's a real issue. So I said that technologies have amazing potential. But the reality is, the research shows, and we've done research in our own institution, in a number of institutions I've worked in, as well as other research done by colleagues, that actually most institutions are simply using the virtual learning environment as a content repository. They're just putting up Word files and PDFs and nothing more. It's the notion of electronic page turning. They're not harnessing the power to really use these technologies for active engagement, for active learning, for really fostering communication and collaboration between students. Now, this is a real issue, and it's quite a complex issue. And at the heart of it is the issue that both teachers and students lack the necessary digital literacy skills to be really able to make effective use of technologies. So yes, today's learners may well have grown up in a technological environment. They can't imagine a world without Google. They can't imagine not having access to these technologies. But just because they know how to Google for resources in general, or how to use tools like Facebook to communicate with their friends, it doesn't mean they have the necessary digital literacy academic skills to be able to harness these appropriately for their learning. So in the old days, we had to teach students how to read an academic book. You don't necessarily read an academic book from page one to the end. You look at the index, you look at the contents list, you might point students to particular bits, you might teach them how to annotate, how to find information, how to evaluate whether it's effective. We need to do exactly the same now. So we need to teach students the skills for evaluating whether a particular resource they find online is relevant for their learning, and then how to actually use it. The other issue is, if you ask teachers why they're not using technologies more, and we've done this, we've interviewed lots of teachers, they say, we haven't got the necessary skills, we don't know how to do it. We're overwhelmed by the plethora of technologies, and we're worried about the support issues. If I'm going to use this technology, what happens if it breaks down? And this has been at the heart of research that I've been doing in the last 15 years or so, to help teachers rethink their design practice. Most teachers, when they go about creating learning activities, think about content. They focus on the content. So the learning design work we've done helps teachers think beyond content to the actual activities the students will engage with and their ultimate learner experience. And they're very, very simple activities and tools that really start from where teachers are and help them step by step to transform their practice. We've run hundreds of thousands of workshops now around the world, and teachers say it really helps them rethink, it helps them be more creative, it helps them be more expressive in terms of how they're doing it. And all of those tools are, of course, freely available online.
So interaction and being able to gauge the feedback is very important, and that's one of the key advantages of technology and the flipped classroom concept. Mm-hmm. So it sounds ideal in theory, where you get students to do the readings in advance so that the professor doesn't have to spend classroom time lecturing about what's in the reading itself. But in practice, what usually happens is students come to class having not done the reading, so it becomes an unproductive session, or it's dominated by the few who did do the reading. What can be done to circumvent this?
Yeah, absolutely. And the notion of the flipped classroom has been around for a long time. It's just that technologies take it to a different dimension, because students can use mobile devices, they can harness resources online, they can interact, as you say, with rich interactive video. Yes, it is an issue, and it always has been. And I think the way to address that is to really make it clear to the learners what the benefits of adopting a flipped classroom approach is. So getting them to do, as you say, the readings or the videos in advance, using the classroom session to be much more active, to have much more discussion and interaction, and encouraging them to participate in these different ways. So, and then monitoring that. So if students do come to the classroom having not engaged, saying, okay, well, next time you need to make sure you've done that. You could also, again, use learning analytics and check that the students have gone through the materials, and if not, maybe a day before send a polite reminder and say, you haven't looked at these guys, you really need to just spend a little bit of time on that. So I think it is about getting students to be much more active and independent learners, and that's a key feature of today. We need to move beyond knowledge recall. We're teaching learners who are going to be growing up in a world that's digitally immersed, we're training them to do jobs that don't even exist today. So we can't just talk about knowledge recall. We have to focus on critical thinking skills, problem solving, teamwork, independence, so that they can adapt. Most learners will have 2, 3, 4 careers. They will be flipping between these different careers. So the content knowledge, the discipline knowledge, is less important than actually the kind of more general competencies.
On the show today is Grania Kuno, Professor of Learning Innovation at the University of Leicester. I'll ask her how technology is affecting learning up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. If you have just joined us, we are speaking today to Professor Grania Kuno from the University of Leicester. She specializes in learning innovation, and that is the topic of our conversation today. Before we left off, we talked a lot about how the challenges of integrating technology into the classroom, but how much do we know about the efficacy of digital learning in the classroom itself?
Good question. I mean, we've had research now into e-learning, as it's often referred to, or more broadly, the use of technologies in a learning context, for a good 15 years or more, I'd say, particularly since the emergence of the internet. And there's been ongoing debate about, is it good or bad? And the first question that people naively ask is the use of technologies better than the traditional classroom? How does it compare? And actually, that's an inappropriate question, because it's like comparing oranges with apples. Introducing technology fundamentally changes the interactions between the students and the learners and the way the students are learning. So rather than comparing with the traditional, we need to research and understand what the students are doing. We need to understand their perceptions of the use of technology. So there's been some excellent research in the UK funded by the Joint Information Systems Committee, which looked at what was called the learner experience. So they followed learners, they looked at how they were using technologies, they found out about their perceptions, and that information can be fed back to the teacher, so the teacher can make a better assessment. Now, researching how students are learning is a daily part of a teacher's role. So if a teacher is in a classroom, they're constantly automatically looking at the learners. If they're seeing that everybody's asleep in the corner, then they might need to do something. And it's the same in an online environment or use of technologies. But the advantage is we've got lots of tools where we can actually see what the learners are doing, and we can feed that back to the teacher so that they can improve their design practice. And as I said before the break, rethinking the design practice is key. So teachers think about the vision for the course, what they want the learners to achieve, and only then think, okay, having that context, what kind of technologies might be important. And it's also true that it's about mixing the physical spaces with the digital spaces. So how can we technology enhance our classroom spaces to make more effective use of technologies? How can we ensure that if students are bringing in their own devices, whether they be smartphones or laptops or smart devices, how can those be integrated into the classroom and used? It's simple things like, where are the plug sockets? Can we reconfigure the classroom so that at a flash we can change from a lecture orientated approach through to small group work? So how can we technology enhance physical spaces? There's been a great project in Australia on this called the Spaces for Knowledge Generation project. If you Google Spaces for Knowledge Generation and learning and design, you'll find the site. And there's an excellent report. They did a massive study tour around the world of innovative spaces and came up with a set of 7 design principles to ensure the classroom can be technologically enhanced.
How do you feel about students using laptop in your classroom today? There's a lot of pushback from professors who have a no laptop policy in their classroom because it distracts from the classroom learning environment. It affects how lecturer interacts with the student as well.
Two parts in answer to that. Firstly, I think we do need to help teachers rethink what they're doing to show them the benefits. I think having mobile devices in classrooms is great. I would say that. So introducing it is saying, okay, well, where are we going to start to? If they're worried about students being in Facebook all the time, if the students are in Facebook, it's because they're not engaged with the learning. So we need to make the learning interesting for them. It was the same before laptops existed. Okay, they might not be in Facebook, but they're doodling or they're sending little notes to their friends across the classroom. So we need to ensure that the students are engaged, they're motivated, they see the benefits of learning. And we need to maybe actively engage them in some of these social spaces and use them. So it might be that we have a system whereby students can text questions during the session. So it might be that at a certain point a teacher stops and has a little quiz and students have answers, and it's clear that 90% of the students don't understand that particular concept and it's anonymous, so the teacher can stop and readdress that. So I think it's really important to engage with this. In Leicester, we've been experimenting with the use of iPads in our education department, in criminology, and most recently in medicine. So all our first-year medical students are given iPads as part of their registration package, and they're actively using them. My team have been evaluating that use, and it's been incredibly positive because the trainee doctors can have access to all the wealth of resources and medical textbooks. They can take annotations, they can take pictures, they can interact with each other. So it's been even the students who didn't like it at first have come round to realising it's a huge benefit.
Giving an iPad to every student would raise the cost of tuition because it's being included in the tuition fees. Does this not make the higher education experience more unreachable? And is the current business model of higher education sustainable?
Excellent question. I mean, as you probably know, in the UK, we've introduced tuition fees up to £9,000 a year. So you're fundamentally changing the relationship with the learners. Many people are talking about learners as consumers. So learners are rightly demanding, well, what am I getting for this £9,000? A friend of mine's son just had his first year, and his father was furious because the last term, this summer term, his son wasn't being tutored at all. He was just doing independent study. And his father was saying, what am I paying all this money for if, you know, he's not being tutored? So I think what we have to notice is we really need to think as institutions, whether we're schools or higher education, what are the benefits of coming to this particular university? What are the students getting? And this is we're increasingly seeing a spectrum from free resources, often called open educational resources, free courses, often called massive open online courses, through to complete formal traditional educational offerings. Learners are all different and have different needs, and they will fit along that spectrum. My own daughter, elder daughter, has been researching which university to go to. She's done lots of research online, and she's chosen to go to Bristol University because that meets her needs. UNESCO argue that there are more than 10 million learners who can't afford access to formal education. So how can we support them? How can open educational resources and MOOCs, massive open online courses, be able to enable them to overcome the poverty gap, to look at how they can get, if you like, a step on the ladder? We also have to recognise that an 18-year-old student in India who's studying computer science to get a job has very different needs to a 45-year-old who's learning Spanish, who doesn't really want the accreditation, but they might want support through a community. So I think we're both seeing a spectrum from the free to the formal to the paid. We're also seeing what I call a disaggregation of education. So yes, I can buy a book online, a digital version, but actually I may want the physical artefact. A lot of us still like physical books. Yes, I may want to work through resources on my own, or I might want to have some kind of formal guided learning pathway to help me through. I might want some form of support, some network of peers I can interact with, or some access to a tutor to guide me. And finally, some people will choose to pay for accreditation. So there's an organisation called the OERU, based originally out of New Zealand. It's an international consortium of universities. Students can choose to learn through various resources, and then they can go to UNISA in South Africa or Athabasca in Canada and say, OK, I've learnt this, I want accreditation through your university and I'm prepared to pay for it. So we're starting to see very interesting new business models emerge, and ways in which people can get accreditation for learning through free resources or MOOCs, such as OERU, but also through digital badges. So I can work through something and I could be given a digital badge to say I've learnt this much content. In our own institution, We're part of the Future Learn initiative of MOOCs, and we've run two courses about Richard III, one of our kings, and one on forensic science because of the kind of mass cult interests in the TV series CSI. And through that, students can work through it and pay £25 to get a certificate of participation. So we're starting to see very new, interesting business models. And I think it's like an ecology. Ultimately, things will settle down from the free, as I say, through to the formal. And the extreme is the Oxford or Cambridge model, the one-to-one tea and crumpets by the fire with your tutors. For some people, that will be appropriate. For others, they may just want to work through materials for free and just interact through social media.
Yeah, online courses and videos, they take away the admission process, right? Anyone can do it, and it's so affordable. But if they can do it, wouldn't students always want to get accreditation from the elite universities? Wouldn't the non-elite universities be threatened?
No, I don't think so. I think students, potential students, have very different needs, and different institutions fit those needs. One of the things I think is really exciting about MOOCs, it's what I would call a disruptive innovation, because what it's done is it's made traditional institutions stop and think about what is the process, what is the benefit of coming to Leicester University as opposed to going to Cambridge University. What are the different benefits? My own daughter, for example, went on a visit to Oxford University. She had a two-day meeting there, and she hated it. It just didn't suit her. Now, Oxford, you know, and she's chosen to go to Bristol, which is also a very good university. But for her, she liked the city. She liked the atmosphere of Bristol. It much better met her needs. And in the UK, some of the kind of newer universities, which were polytechnics, are often much more practically applied and suit particular needs. So, for example, film studies is a big course at Kingston University in London. And so for some students, if they want something that's practically applied, one particular university will be important over another one. So, as I say, I think the benefits of things like MOOCs are that they're helping to rethink and state more clearly to students why it's beneficial to come to Leicester, what they will get in terms of the learning experience. I don't think there's a vice-chancellor, provost or rector in the world who isn't thinking about the impact of MOOCs. And we know that MOOCs were labelled, the New York Times, 2012 was the year of the MOOC. So MOOCs may come and go, but if they do nothing else, if they make us think and define more clearly what our learning offerings are, then that's great.
So it seems like kids and students are moving towards the direction of unsupervised learning. They can learn on their own with the technology, and the teacher would have minimal or no role at all. So what is the role of the teachers or even a structured classroom in this new environment?
Yeah. I'll go back a stage. When the internet first emerged, people were scaremongering and saying, oh, it's the death of librarians. There's no need for librarians anymore. Actually, in reality, librarians' roles changed because of technologies, and they've become really important stakeholders in terms of being digital curators, in terms of promoting digital literacy skills. I think, inevitably, because of technologies, teachers' roles will and indeed have to change. But that's good, I think. I think they will move from being perhaps presenters more towards supporters, towards enablers. And again, going back to what I said before about the kind of skills we need to engender in tomorrow's learners in terms of critical thinking, problem solving, creativity, innovation, group work, etc. So it's how the teachers can foster and support that. Yes, learners can learn anything on the internet. I mean, why go to an institution in a way? But actually, most of us need guidance. I've been trying to learn Spanish for years. But actually, I did two formal courses at the Open University UK because I wanted that guidance and support, because I wanted the deadlines, because I wanted the feedback. So the role will change, but I think we as teachers should be embracing it. I think it's a really exciting time, and I think there's huge benefit in terms of the skills teachers have in from motivation right through to the understanding of the kind of support that learners need. So some, yes, will learn individually, but most need support.
Well, the example you bring up about the librarians is very interesting because theirs is a profession that has been dramatically reduced because some of their job functions is no longer relevant in the technological age. Mm-hmm. Same goes for teacher, I'm assuming. With the structured classroom and deadlines as well, these will come with technological advances. Some apps already has artificial intelligence of, mm-hmm. of a personal coach, for example, yes. like a Duolingo, which reminds you that today you have to complete a certain amount of exercises.
That's right.
There's a workbook. So I was wondering, would it seems like the role of the teacher would be dramatically reduced to being just a function of assessing, like marking. Is that where you see the future lies?
I don't at all. I think there will be new skills for them to support and foster and enable learning. Yes, assessment, of course, will still be an important component. It always has been an important component and will continue to be. I mean, roles will change. You're absolutely right. I mean, if we take the role of a secretary in the past, a manager would dictate a letter and the secretary would type it up. That role has gone because now most people actually type up their own letters. But the role has evolved. It's perhaps better to say people have personal assistants or executive assistants, and they're sometimes called in certain parts of the world. So they might, because the interaction in the digital space is so much more complex because we all have millions of emails. Part of the role of the personal assistant might be to manage their diary, for example, in terms of prioritising responses to emails. So I think roles will inevitably change. Some jobs and roles will die out, but others will emerge. So I'm quite positive. Again, I like to use the analogy of ecology. It's like survival of the fitness. We interact with these technologies in our personal preferences. Some of us love Facebook. You know, I'm always posting pictures of cats and food. Some of us hate technologies like Facebook. And that's fine. So a technology would have a set of characteristics, so Facebook for socialising and from sharing things. Whether or not we take up those characteristics and benefit from them will depend on our personal preference. So there's a kind of relationship, a changing, evolving dynamic between us and the technologies over time.
Professor, how do you come to this view? Because I imagine that this is a relatively new development and we're thinking about and researching about things that didn't even exist back 20 or 10 years ago. I was just wondering, what is the career trajectory or evolution of your professional interests and how you got to your field today?
Good question. I mean, I started life as a lecturer in chemistry and evolved into this. I've recently done a e-learning timeline where I've looked at the key technologies that are important for learning that have emerged over the last 30 years. So I start in the late 80s with the emergence of rich interactive media. Of course, 1993 was the emergence of the web, right through to, of course, things like MOOCs in the last few years. And it's really interesting to see each of those and to see the impact they have. But also we can't, again, the ecological perspective is useful because we can't predict where things will go with the internet. I mean, none of us could have imagined the emergence of the web or the profound impact it would have on our lives. I mean, none of us could. And it's amazing to think it's only 1993. It's 21 years old, that's all. And our children look at us in horror when we talk about a world before the computer. It's like, what? You know, that can't be true.
What was the previous game changer that before the internet?
I think it was rich interactive multimedia. The computer,
before the internet.
The computer. Yeah. I think the emergence of the computer was a game changer, absolutely. But it's interesting, technologies often aren't used in the way that we expect, and we evolve our use. Think of the way you use email. It's probably different now to when you first use it. I was last week in Sweden, and I went down to breakfast, and I was very amused to see an iPad on the countertop next to a fruit dispenser, and it had pictures of all the different fruit juices, and you press the iPad for orange juice and the dispenser started pouring, and then you press it again and it stopped. I thought, I bet Apple couldn't have imagined that, that was how an iPad was going to be actually used. So we evolve, as I say, with our technologies, and we each have our own personal set, personal learning environment of things we like and don't like. So many people know I hate email. So if you want to get hold of me, probably Facebook chat me or tweet me.
One last question. People going to or thinking about going to university would always have this practical end goal in mind, right? Am I going to university to get a job, or am I going there for an education? But from our conversation today, it seems like we're training for jobs that aren't there yet, or jobs that might not be there when we get there. How would you advise, or what message would you give to people thinking about their tertiary education, and how what should be their primary motivation in going into it?
Good question. So I think, again, it goes back to saying, think beyond content and discipline knowledge to active engagement, to development of competencies in different ways. I mean, my PhD in chemistry is useless. I mean, you know, none of the content, most of which I've forgotten anyway, is of any relevance at all in today's world and today's job. But what is relevant for my chemistry days is the kind of visualization skills I developed, the kind of project management skills, the way of converting between numerical and textual. So those more generic skills are actually absolutely vitally important in my job today, rather than the actual content. So I think it is important to help teachers see this kind of and look to this complex future world. The European Initiative, European Union has been bringing together educators with representatives from the ICT industry recently, because there's a real issue about the skills gap in terms of the needs of the ICT industry. And so the EU is helping to foster a link between a partnership between industry and higher education to ensure that higher education institutions are actually developing employees of the future that meet the needs of industry.
Thank you very much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today, Professor.
It's a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
I've been speaking today to Professor Grainer Cunnell from the University of Leicester, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.